a disconnect from problems and craziness and brokenness. But this disconnect has to be the beginning of a new connection. And that connection is to God, is with God. Now, we said last week, if you were here last week, that once you are consecrated, once you are set apart for God, then what happens is you continue this separation and nurture the separation by focusing on the word of his grace. Why? Because this is why. Anybody that is not committed to God is committed to something else. There is not such a thing as no commitment. There's no free agents in this world. And the number one thing that you and I are always committed, haven't been committed, before we committed to God was self. So think about it for a second. Grace is simply the ability to be free from self, because grace, the prerequisite for you to receive and experience God's grace is for you to stop, and I'm saying stop, because when you are committed to yourself versus committed to God, you and I, we walk with a sense of entitlement. And entitlement is like greed. You never see it in the mirror. Nobody looks in the mirror and says, I'm greedy. You typically say, I say, I'm a go-getter. I'm just a driven person. I'm a firstborn, so I always, you know. No, you're greedy, bro. I'm just greedy. It's greed. The same thing happens with entitlement. You typically don't think in entitlement. So last week, I gave you the analogy of atheism, that atheism makes sense. If you're an atheist or you know anybody that's an atheist, it makes sense in this regard. It's wrong, but it makes sense. Because atheism, what atheism argues is, if there is a God, he owes me. If God exists, then the flooding in the Carolinas should not happen. Where is God? If there is a God, cancer shouldn't be my reality. If there is a God, does that make sense? In other words, there's a sense of entitlement that if God exists, and most atheists argue that God does not exist because of the brokenness of the world, which implies, here's what it implies, that we do not take responsibility of what we have done, because you and I know most suffering in this world is self-inflicted. When you commit yourself to you, that's the number one enemy for you. So when you are saved and you commit yourself to God, God saves you from three things. And some of you need to write this down. The number one thing that God saves you from is from God himself. Because you do not want to face the wrath, the majesty, the holiness of God on your own. That's why you need a mediator. So the first thing you need to be saved from is God's wrath. In other words, here's my point. Hell, this is what hell is. Hell is nothing else but an eternity facing the holiness of God without a mediator. I know it's eternal punishment, but really what you don't want to be consumed by is, what you need to fear the most is God. That's all that I'm trying to tell you. Why? Because I keep on bringing this up over and over again. Hollywood gives you this dichotomy that the fight is between evil and good, or good and evil, which in reality what Hollywood says is, you got to fear Satan. And I want to remind you, as powerful as Satan is, and as evil as Satan is, and he is powerful, he is evil, Satan is still a servant of God. Does that make sense? We just sang about how God creates with his breath. He creates the universe. He creates everything. So Satan is a created being. Does that make sense? In other words, be careful that you do not put Satan at the same level with God. This is why Hollywood is wrong. The battle is never between God and Satan. The battle is between you, plural, all of us, and Satan. So number one thing that you're free or safe from is God. Second thing that you're safe from is hell. You're safe from hell. Obviously, no eternal damnation for you. But the third thing that you're safe from is you. So once again, if you want to experience, again, the fullness of everything that you believe, connected to everything that you do, I do, it has to begin by a commitment to God and the freedom that we do not demand grace from God, but instead that we, instead of asking why me, the question is why not, which this grace, this freedom can do what? Now, what's the opposite of building up? Think about it. Because if you're committed to yourself, that implies the opposite of building up. And typically we call that mental illness, depression, and I'm not a psychologist, and I do not minimize any of these mental, emotional problems, but I'm just telling you right now, the brokenness of our lives, the brokenness of sin and illness is the result of self-inflicted pain. We openly and defiantly said no to the commitment of God, we demand grace, and we are tearing each other apart. So here's the point. When you commit to God and you experience the fullness of his grace that you do not demand it, you simply enjoy it, what it does, it builds in you, and the U.S. plural, the building in you is not of a better version of yourself. The building is of the building of the character and the person of Jesus Christ. Because the win is always Jesus. So I'm all for us to be a better, you know, community and families and church and country, but this is about Jesus in our community, in our families. And now here's the challenge that we said last week. Once Jesus has been built up in you, that implies that now you have a different perspective of the inheritance. The inheritance. In other words, just translate this into the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, you had these people walking for 40 years in the wilderness, you know, circles and circles and circles, eventually show up to the promised land. In the promised land, they fell in love with the inheritance of the land, which is perfectly fine. But if you remember, and this is where the concept of the holy war comes into place, the first thing that God tells Joshua as he enters the promised land, he tells Joshua to wipe everything off the land. And you're going to kill the senior adult, the young couple, the kid, and their goldfish, and their pet, and everything. You're going to consume this with fire in a symbolism of consecration to me. What do? They do exactly the opposite. They fall in love with the land versus the God who gave them the land. So what I'm telling you right now is once Jesus has been built up in you, the inheritance becomes God himself. So what's the win? What's the win of your commitment to God? What's the win of being free from self? What's the win to see the character of Jesus being built up in you? It's not a better life. It's not simply the improvement of abilities and achieving the dreams, and I'm all for your life and the dreams. You know what the win is? That at the end, you get God. So Paul says, here's how the whole thing ended last week. What that implies is that you and I, we get the place that we belong to in this whole economy of God. The gospel is nothing else but the person and the work of Jesus. So through the person, through the work of Jesus, I am, you are a manager. What would be the opposite? Without the gospel, you are, or you may think that I am, what is it? An owner. That's when you and I behave and think like no one tells me what to do. Everybody owes me. Right? That's why we don't get along, because everybody owes me. And then this is the moment where the gospel becomes distorted. So this morning, I want you to think and process this, because Paul says, okay, if I'm a manager of God, this is what it means. That means, verse 33, that I have not. In other words, people who behave and do life as owners, not managers, but owners, meaning that Jesus, God, the Holy Spirit, they are cosmic butlers to me. They exist to serve me. See, when I call upon God, he better do what I tell him to do. Anybody tracking? That's an owner. When somebody, you know, looks at God and blames him for everything that is happening in the world. See, a manager is a steward of the person of Jesus and the work of Jesus. And Paul says, because I'm a manager, I have not coveted. And he's speaking to pastors. And here's the implication. Here's the implication that you guys either are, or you guys will eventually get into this whole dynamic of loving silver, loving gold, and loving clothing more than you love the God who provides silver, the God who provides gold, and the God who provides clothing. If you read the scriptures, you're going to discover that Paul is going to be accused of being greedy. So this morning, here's what I want you to understand. Because obviously wealth, and when I say wealth, is the description of these three things. Silver, gold, and clothing. Wealth is amoral, meaning is neutral. Because wealth is like sex. Sex is a beautiful thing, but it can be very detrimental. Does that make sense? So sex in itself is not wrong if it's done within the boundaries of God's purposes. Wealth is not wrong. We never apologize for being blessed. Anybody tracking what I'm saying? We do not apologize for the blessings. For being a nation that is blessed beyond our ability to manage, we do not apologize. But Paul is warning these pastors, these elders, that you will find, they will show up in your church, people with false teaching. And the false teaching is basically when you and I start coveting by becoming or thinking that we're owners. So if you're a single individual, ladies and men, but ladies especially, my suggestion as you choose and as you make yourself available, do you hear me say that, ladies? You choose and you make it. In other words, stop just praying for a man, because praying for a man and not making yourself available is like praying for a job and never filling up an application. It's like, how do I pray for you? You gotta apply. Anyway, if you're gonna do that, see, when you choose a spouse or you choose a boyfriend or a girlfriend, what you wanna do is you wanna find someone, and I'm gonna speak to men primarily. Ladies, you want a man that is under other men. And that under is called the local church. That's all that I'm trying to tell you. So if you're dating someone that doesn't wanna go to church, doesn't want accountability, my suggestion, friendly and lovingly, run from that relationship. Why? This is why. Because look at what's happening. He's basically telling you that that's false teaching. So false teaching plus wealth, what it does, it creates greed, which is giving you the motives of the heart. And then in this time in history, false teaching not only included the financial gain of, you know, self-indulgence, entitlement, which that was a lot of corruption in the church, still is, obviously, in today, but the other one is sexual misconduct. So when you think about today that you get all these kinds of definitions of Christians, and if you are this kind of Christian, it's nothing else but false teaching. So Paul is basically saying, here's what he's saying, for us, the issue is not wealth, the issue is false teaching, or the opposite of false teaching is not right teaching, it's Christ-likeness. In other words, when you've been entrusted with silver, gold, clothing, those are the elements that he describes. When you've been entrusted with wealth, and you've been entrusted with knowledge, you've been entrusted with youth, you've been entrusted with children, grandchildren, some of you have been entrusted with retirement. What a blessing is to get to that place of retirement. Whatever you've been entrusted with, when you bring Christ-likeness into the conversation, because those experiences are amoral. Okay, can I just say that again? Amoral. They're neutral. There's nothing wrong with being retired, nothing wrong with having two jobs, nothing wrong with this being a stay-home mom. Anybody tracking what I'm saying? The issue is not the world. The issue is Christ-likeness. When you do that, Paul says, I never coveted because everything that I possess, even my apostleship, my ability to convey the gospel, was to portray, to bring forth the motives, not my Jewishness, right? Because think about it. If it was up to me, Paul says, the last time that I promoted my motives, I was on the road to Damascus. To do what? To kill infidels, to kill Christians. Remember that? So if you live it up to me, that's the beauty of grace. Please listen to me for a second. The beauty of grace is that, and again, this is kind of a little confusing topic, but this is the way I process why I understand the scriptures. I believe grace is the ability, the supernatural ability of God to restrain our evil within us. Because when Paul was free from expressing evil, he was killing Christians. Not because Paul was deeper into evil or he was more broken than everybody else. I'm just picturing right now that for us to be where we are and able to process life the way it is God's restraining our brokenness, because you and I gotta be honest. If it was up to us and motives, we will be pretty bad people. I don't know if that makes any sense. In other words, Paul is saying wealth plus Christ-likeness is not your motives, it's the motives of Christ, and wealth plus Christ-likeness is the actions of Jesus Christ. Well, these actions and these motives, Paul is going to exemplify by simply saying this as we close our time. He says, you yourselves, again, leaders, pastors, people in charge, people responsible to manage instead of owning the church, you need to know that this hands. In other words, just listen. Because parents, and most of you will eventually be parents, so you need to listen to this. When we speak of Christ-likeness and school, Christ-likeness in relationships, Christ-likeness in sexuality, Christ-likeness in whatever it is that you have, whoever it is that you do. And the goal is to portray the motives and the actions of Christ. Paul says, this is not just something doctrinal. This is something that is reflected with my hands, that I literally supply my own needs. Because Paul, in the book of Corinthians, he's going to be accused that he was in for the money. That he was doubtful, he was questionable in his integrity. And Paul says, I never took money from you. And then he says, not only that, but I also provided for the needs of those who travel with me. What's the point? Listen to me for a second. What Paul is saying, this is chapter 20. Paul is on his way to Jerusalem to be house arrested, to be incarcerated, trial, and very soon executed. And as he finishes the journey, and as he knows that unavoidably there is a wave of false teaching, that if you read the second chapter of the book of Revelation, John, a different apostle, writes to the seven churches. Some of these churches listed in the book of Revelation, they're not going to make it. They're not going to make it. Why? Because of false teaching. And Paul says, I want to make sure that you understand that the opposite of false teaching is not simply the proper theology or right way of thinking or the right doctrine. See, the opposite of false teaching is my integrity, that through the work of my hands is that I keep myself, listen to me, I keep myself innocent. You have nothing on me. I've worked on my own. But my innocence became means to an end. Because we said from the beginning that the whole purpose of the entire deal is management, not ownership. It's a stewardship, not entitlement. And Paul understood that by saying, because of the hard work of my hands, it's not a badge of honor against those who are lazy, against those who are not like me, against those false teachers. What Paul is saying, my work, hard work with my hands, is simply to bless others. And folks, I'm going to say this again. This understanding of innocence and becoming a blessing to others, there is so much freedom. Why? Because theologically or spiritually and emotionally, I've explained this to you multiple times and I'm going to explain it to you again. Your forgiveness, your innocence, you going back to square one and becoming or being placed in the same position that Adam was before he sinned. Before he disconnected from God, Adam only was innocent. Adam was not righteous. There was only one man that walked on this earth as a righteous individual. And his name is the second Adam, Jesus Christ. So please look at me for a second. When I speak of your forgiveness of your sins, which I hope and you have made that experience habitual, and you are an individual that have worked with your hands and work hard, and you're sitting in this place as part of the generation that you're hard workers, please listen to me for a second. Your work and your innocence has to be a vehicle towards blessing and displaying and conveying not your righteousness, but the righteousness of the one who makes you righteous. I don't know if I'm making any sense this morning. The tendency is to look at our own forgiveness and how you have improved and how you have been, you know, so tenacious. And after all these struggles and ups and downs, here you are standing. And I'm glad you are. And I give you credit for your abilities and your desire and your learning ability. But at the end of the day, if it's not conveying the righteousness of Jesus Christ, this is futile. This is completely pointless. Why? This is why. Because he closes by simply saying, it is partially, conveniently, seasonally. What does he say? See, the word everything implies all that I believed, the transformation of my heart and my mind was reflected on my behavior. So what I know and who I am is always expressed on what I do. Anybody follow me what I'm saying? In other words, our behavior doesn't define who we are. Who we are defines our behavior. Translation, because I lie doesn't make me a liar. I'm a liar, and that's why I lied. You see the difference? Because our tendency is to say, well, just go to therapy. Just get a counselor. Get accountability. And I'm all for those things, and those things are helpful. But the problem with your heart and my heart is that we have divorced the everything. We typically think, okay, this is what I believe, but this is really what I do. This is what I know, but this is how I react to life and other things. So he says, hey, in everything that I did, not just believe, I show you that by this kind of, what is it? Not just hard belief, hard work. I work hard. I'm a part of the generation, Paul says, that my work that was, you know, committed, and we read earlier that he was with these churches for 3 years in Ephesus, and he says, everything that you have seen is simply means to an end. What is the end? The help of the, say it with me, the help of the weak. Now look at me for a second, because I gotta finish. It's so late. But I gotta finish, and I gotta say this because this is so crucial for me and just understanding what this means. Anytime that you have a generation, a family, an individual that divorces the belief from the action, what I think and what I do, and you divorce it. Anytime that you have a generation who the opposite of hard work is not soft work, is laziness. Anytime that you have a generation that, because we are in a governmental system that allows and condones laziness, there is people who can work and chooses not to work. Am I speaking to anybody? There is people in our generation who call themselves Christians, and they promote, anytime that you do this, look at me for a second, you have a generation that is confused about the weak. And what does that mean? Here's what it means. In the book of Exodus, when Moses takes the people of God from Egypt into the promised land, they're going to circle in the wilderness for 40 years. And in 40 years, God provided something that is called aid, like a teacher aid, aid. And this aid, what it meant is if God did not provide this, the people will die. Example, manna from heaven, the cloth that never tear apart, the cloud during the day, the column of fire. In other words, that was God's divine intervention. In today's world, we have people that they need our intervention. If we don't help them, they're going to die. Once they entered the promised land, all of those things went away, and God provided not aid, but help, implying he provided the land, he provided everything, but they had to. They have to toil the soil. They have to work, and they worked. What's the point? Here's the point. That in today's economy, in our system, because we as a nation, we have divorced what we believe and what we do, because we are promoting ethical behavior that is not conducive to honoring Christ. Listen to me. We have people right now in our system that they are receiving aid when what they need is help. Now, before you say amen, you got to remember that our government only reflects our homes. So let me talk as a parent. As a parent, my number one preoccupation with my children is that I do not give them aid when they need help. So when you have a 25-year-old, 32-year-old at home not working, you have a problem. Anybody tracking? Ladies, gentlemen, if you choose not to work just because, without really understanding the whole complexity of this, you need to understand that what you're doing is you're making everything about yourself. The reason why you're called to work is to reflect the heart of God, because that's the opportunity to bless those in need. And Paul says, I want you to know this principle, because the tendency, as I depart, as I go away and I'm not with you anymore, remember Paul is saying goodbye, this is what's going to happen. You are not going to remember. What's the opposite of remembering? That explains why we have grandparents and then no kids and then maybe the grandkids coming back to church, because the generations have forgotten. And they have forgotten not necessarily systems, which is biblical systems. You know what they have forgotten? You know what the risk is right now as we speak that we might forget? We may forget the words of, come on, say it, the words of. Because I'm telling you, as a father, I strive every day to be the best that I can be. As a couple, you know, Areli and I, we try to be the best that we can be in our jobs and whatever we do, parenting. But at the end of the day, my kids don't need my parental, you know, skills. What they need are the words of Jesus Christ. That's what we need. What we need is not a better president, a better system in the government. We need the words of Jesus to come back. They have been forgotten. And based on the economy of Jesus, Jesus said that it is more blessed to give. It is more blessed that although you, Jewish people, 2,000 years ago, you expected a Messiah, you expected a deliverer, you expected someone that will take all this craziness of the world and make things right, because God is a giver, He did not just give you a Messiah. God gave you Himself. And no Jewish individual on the face of the earth 2,000 years ago expected for God to show up Himself. And that's why when Jesus looks at ill people, sickness, and He says, you can walk away, He says, now you may see. Now come back from the death. People were okay with the farewell teacher, with the guy that was able to help people. But once Jesus said, your sins are forgiven, that's when everything became upside down for the system. This morning, I'm inviting you to look at the heart of Jesus as the giver, to be the example, to be the standard that we blessed others instead of simply focusing on self-indulgence and self-preferences. Would you pray with me for a second?